Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Bruce Alpert, Kelly Jean Kelly, and Phil Dierking. Dan Friedel will tell us what's trending today, and Jill Robbins and Alice Bryant will bring us this week's education report. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
President-elect Donald Trump is being urged not to withdraw the United States from the International Nuclear Agreement with Iran. Members of Trump's Republican Party and other opponents are saying it is better to keep the existing agreement and try to improve it. Trump strongly criticized the nuclear agreement during his presidential campaign. He called it a disaster and the worst deal ever negotiated. During a speech to a pro-Israel group in March, Trump said as president, he would seek to end the disastrous deal with Iran. However, Iran and U.S. allies in Europe have urged the new administration to honor the agreement. The deal was signed by Iran and six world powers in July 2015. It eased economic sanctions on Iran in exchange for limits on Tehran's nuclear program. Iran has rejected calls to renegotiate the agreement. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif urged Trump last week to honor the deal, saying it was not an agreement for one side to be able to scrap. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry took a lead role in negotiating the agreement and called it the good deal we had sought. But many Republicans in the U.S. Congress have been highly critical of it. The deal was created as a political commitment rather than a treaty. The United Nations Security Council resolution that approved it does not require its members to accept it. Legal experts say this means the new administration could simply take no action if it chooses to do so. Edward Swain is a law professor at George Washington University and a former legal advisor to the U.S. State Department. He said the U.S. would not face any direct international legal consequences if it decided to pull out of the agreement. However, some opponents in Congress have changed earlier opinions that the agreement should be canceled. They are now calling for tighter sanctions on Iran and for the agreement to be strictly enforced. Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee is chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He said this week he does not think tearing up the agreement is the right thing to do. He told reporters Monday he thinks Washington should work with its allies to enforce the existing agreement without negotiating a new deal. To me, the best route for the new president to handle this is to push back on the violations that are taking place today. Corker was quoted by the Times Free Press newspaper as saying. Corker said the nuclear deal made it possible for Iran to get back billions of dollars of money seized by the U.S. He added that over time, the agreement means Iran could end up in a much stronger position than they were in the beginning. The Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a conservative research organization in Washington, D.C., agrees. The group was an early supporter of a Stop the Iran Nuclear Deal campaign and urged members of Congress to block the deal. However, the group now opposes canceling it. Orde Kitri is a senior fellow at the foundation. He says if the U.S. withdrew from the deal, Iran would feel free to ignore the restrictions on its nuclear program. He said it would also be very hard to bring back sanctions if the agreement is renegotiated. I'm Brian Lynn.
President-elect Donald Trump says the United States will withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal on his first day in office. Trump promised to block the trade deal during a successful campaign for the presidency. Trump, a Republican businessman, takes office on January 20th, 2017.
Some questioned whether the other 11 countries in the TPP would move ahead with the trade deal without the United States. Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull said all 11 nations want to go forward. Turnbull said more trade means better jobs, and better jobs and stronger economic growth in Australia. But Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said the trade deal is meaningless without the United States. According to the U.S. Commerce Department, the United States is responsible for about 60% of economic production among the 12 TPP countries. Last week, Abe was the first foreign leader to meet with Trump since he won the U.S. presidential election over Democrat Hillary Clinton. In his video speech, Trump said he would give notice of his intent to withdraw from the TPP deal on the first day of his administration. He also promised to negotiate fair bilateral trade deals that bring jobs and industry back onto American shores. That means he would seek to reach trade deals with individual nations rather than groups of nations.
Rajiv Biswas is chief economist for IHS Global in Singapore. He expects the other 11 TPP nations to negotiate other free trade deals that will likely give more trade openings to China.
President Barack Obama was in Lima, Peru recently for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Group meeting. The meeting was part of his last scheduled foreign trip as president. Obama and other Pacific leaders said they continue to support free trade. Obama said free trade can improve the lives of billions of people around the world. But Obama spoke about the message of American voters during the November 8th presidential election. Trump ran on a promise to bring back American manufacturing jobs that he says were lost mainly because of unfair trade deals. Obama said there are benefits to free trade, but he added that large corporations and the wealthy often seem to be playing by a different set of rules.
A new study finds that the natural death of a dictator does not usually lead to a change in a country's governmental system. In other words, remaining leaders are unlikely to put a democratic system in place. Researchers at Michigan State University and the National Intelligence Council carried out the study, titled When Dictators Die. The magazine Journal of Democracy published it. The study found that in most cases, system changes are more probable if a dictator is ousted. The researchers examined almost 80 cases of dictators who died in office between 1946 and 2012. They note that 11 of the 55 dictators now in office are at least 70 years old. Some are not in good health. Erica Franz is an associate professor at Michigan State. She was one of the researchers.
It started about the time of Kim Jong-il's death in North Korea a few years ago, and there was a lot of buzz in the moments afterwards that we might see big change in North Korea. So we decided to dig around and look at the data and see what the empirical record showed, because that's not an atypical situation. The same type of thing happened also after Hugo Chavez's death in Venezuela.
Franz says researchers wanted to know how and when media reports of possible governmental change came true. She said they found that natural death in office was usually, in her words, a non-event. She said leadership changes in dictatorial systems usually come during momentous happenings, such as overthrows, elections, or rebellions. She says an examination of the leadership deaths between 1946 and 2012 shows there are several conditions that might make change more likely. The more centralized the power, she says, the more likely change will happen. In other words, if there are few or no governmental structures to manage the continuation of the system, change is more probable. Franz says pressure, such as protests, on the ruling power in the months before a dictator's death can also increase the likelihood. The study also examined whether overthrows are more likely to take place when a ruler is old. Franz says researchers did not find that to be the case. She says there are lessons to be learned from the study. She says an old dictatorial leader is a sign of a skilled politician who is able to stay in power for a long time.
The other takeaway point, I think, is that leadership transitions more generally are moments that increase a country's baseline risk of regime collapse, but death in office is really not the major moment that we could leverage those types of occurrences.
Researchers say another reason there is little change after a dictatorial ruler dies in office is that top officials see no reason to change policies. Some countries have changed the Constitution to permit them to extend their terms, sometimes by many years. France says they use that method to give the appearance of democracy rather than using force to remain in power. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Post-truth is Oxford Dictionary's Word of the Year. The Oxford Dictionary's website told readers post-truth could be one of the defining words of our time. The term comes from an idea that became popular during the 2016 presidential campaign in the United States. Post-truth, as the website defines it, means to relate to situations where objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. Oxford Dictionary's officials say they chose post-truth as Word of the Year because of its rising popularity. They said the term's usage appeared to increase 2,000% in 2016 alone. Casper Grothwall is the president of Oxford Dictionaries. He said that the choice was no surprise after a year filled with difficult discussions about politics. Grothwall said post-truth has become popular at a time when more people are using social media to get news. Some people trust social media more for news and information than establishment media or political leaders. If you plan to use the word, Oxford Dictionaries defines it as an adjective. An example of it is the expression post-truth politics. The website said that post-truth has gone from being a new term to a word often used in political commentary. Major publications now use the term without feeling the need to define its meaning. A number of other terms were under consideration for Oxford Dictionary's Word of the Year. They included Brexiteer, which means someone who supported Britain's decision to exit or leave the European Union. Another choice was alt-right, which describes a group tied to extreme conservative ideas and known to reject traditional politics. A third possibility was adulting, a noun meaning the action of someone behaving like a responsible adult. It appears that post-truth, with its current meaning, has been in existence for more than 20 years. Oxford Dictionaries found its first use in a 1992 commentary published in The Nation magazine. Steve Tesic, a Serbian-American playwright, used post-truth in writing about the Iran-Contra scandal and the Gulf War. We, as a free people, have freely decided that we want to live in some post-truth world, he wrote. I'm Phil Dierking.
This is what's trending today. The American Thanksgiving holiday is on Thursday. Many people will gather with family members for a big meal. It is a time to celebrate family, friends, and everything there is to be thankful for. The traditional Thanksgiving meal often involves cooking a large bird called a turkey, and many other foods such as stuffing, mashed potatoes, and pumpkin pie. But some people do not look forward to spending a lot of time with their family. It can be stressful. That is why people are proposing Thanksgiving survival strategies using the hashtag Survival Guide to Thanksgiving. Rick Irwin had an idea. Say that you're letting the dog out and use it as an excuse to disappear for several hours. Since there is so much food at the Thanksgiving meal, Christine Turner suggested forgetting about your diet and wearing loose clothing. But one fitness enthusiast said people do not have to give up on their diets during the big meal. They can prepare foods that have fewer calories. For example, they could bake some foods instead of frying them in oil. But other people are looking forward to the holiday. Sarah Marie Brenner wondered why people need to survive Thanksgiving at all. And that's what's trending today. I'm Dan Friedel.
For VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. In developing countries, attending school can be a daily struggle for some children. They may walk several kilometers to school because their families do not have money to send them on buses or other forms of transportation. With schools far away and little money to pay for transport costs, parents worry about the safety of their children walking to school. So, a number of parents keep their children at home, or the child drops out of school. They leave without completing their studies. These and other barriers to school attendance are the reality for many girls in poor countries. But now, programs in two developing countries are helping to change that. The programs are giving girls pedal power, transportation in the form of bicycles. Rural areas of poor countries often have few secondary schools. So, it is common for students there to travel great distances to attend classes. Bihar is the poorest state in India. 90% of the state's population lives in rural areas. Until 2007, too many teenage girls in Bihar were dropping out of school. For Nahid Farzana, her home was 6 kilometers from school, and her father did not have money for bus fare, she told the Associated Press. But that same year, the state government began offering bicycles to girls to help them get to school. The program has been so effective that 3 nearby states are now doing the same. And the results are measurable. A 2014 study found that giving bicycles to teenage girls in India increased their secondary school enrollment by 30%. It also helped many of them stay in school long enough to take their final exams. Western Kenya is experiencing success with a similar program. Until recently, there was a high risk of local girls dropping out of school and then becoming pregnant. Lois Luceno is a 16-year-old girl from Kakamega, Kenya. In the past, she had to walk about 10 kilometers to reach school. Last year, she dropped out temporarily because of the distance. Members of her family work as subsistence farmers. They earn just about $30 a month, not nearly enough for food, school costs, and transport. But a few months ago, Luceno went back to school, this time on a bicycle. Her new form of transportation was provided by World Bicycle Relief, an American-based group.
Christina Kwok is an expert on girls' education at the Brookings Institution, a research organization in Washington, D.C. Kwok recently told VOA that in many countries, girls face a long list of barriers to school attendance. Sometimes the issue is that a society has firm ideas about what girls can and shouldn't do as they become young women, including whether they should receive an education. Luceno experienced this. When girls in her community walked to school, motorbike riders would stop them on the road. They would offer the girls rides to school. Then, they would try to persuade the girls to drop out. Kwok says another reason girls may not attend school is their family. Parents might believe that losing children's help at home can cause the family to lose money. For example, a poor farming family grows less food without the help of children. Girls are often expected to do this work. In many cases, those household duties include taking care of younger brothers and sisters. There are also direct financial barriers, says Kwok, such as school fees, books, and meals. So, in places where families value boys more than girls, and parents have little money, the boys are sent to school. Even with the success of the bicycle programs, there are still problems. Ainea Ambulwa teaches at the Bukawaya Secondary School in Kakamega, Kenya. He belongs to a bicycle supervisory committee at the school. He makes sure that the riders are keeping their vehicles in good condition. Ambulwa says defeating poverty remains a difficult issue. He says that some families will put heavy things on the bicycles and then they break down. Because the family lacks the money to have the bicycle repaired, the girl can no longer get to school. World Bicycle Relief is based in Chicago, Illinois. It provides bicycles through another group, World Vision. In 2015, the two groups launched a bicycle production factory in Kisumu, Kenya. The cost of the bicycle is around $180. That is too much money for most families in rural Kenya. But with the help of donors, the program has given away about 7,000 bicycles throughout the country. Most of the people receiving the bikes are girls. Bicycles decrease the safety risks for girls because the girls get to school quicker, Kwok explains. It also helps parents not to lose work time taking their girls to school. Peter Wachuli, the head of the program in Kenya, says the bikes have improved children's lives. But, he says, the factory was built around 100 kilometers from Kakamega. So getting the bicycles to needy families can be a problem. Yet, Kwok calls the bicycle programs very promising and a low-cost solution. She says many organizations in wealthier countries would be happy to provide this kind of resource. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.